Good morning, everyone. Thanks for getting up so early. I'm not used to it either. So I've spoken at ISSYP twice, and the first time I tried to write a talk that was sort of aimed at advanced high school students, and the second time I ran out of time and didn't have time to do that, and it was sort of a chaos talk where I just took the slides from a research seminar, very lightly edited, and relied on the audience to heckle when I didn't define things properly. The second talk was way more popular, so I'm going to do it again. These are the slides from a seminar I gave a couple of months ago. And I think actually that you guys will have no problem getting into it, but if I made some minor error, like leaving a term undefined on a slide or assuming some piece of background, then just feel free on behalf of yourself and everyone else in the room to heckle me and make me explain better. So I'm going to talk, we have 90 minutes, and it's actually supposed to be a 60-minute talk, so there's tons of time, and if we get sidetracked by like little discussions or something, that's fine. I'm going to talk about CHIME, which is this telescope that my collaborators and I built recently in British Columbia. It's the first new Canadian research telescope in 40 years. It's a radio telescope, which means that it doesn't observe at optical wavelengths, it observes at radio wavelengths at a frequency range around 400 to 800 megahertz. So I should say that CHIME is the work of about 200 people in total. That includes everyone from antenna engineers to people at Titan Bolts on the telescope to people like me that just mostly do software and coming up with new algorithms, like new math ideas to power the software. So I'll talk a little bit about how our telescope differs from a normal radio telescope. As you can see, it's a traditional radio telescope, it's sort of intuitive how it works. There's this dish with motors that you point at a spot on the sky that you want to observe. CHIME is these four cylinders that just sit on the ground with no moving parts. One thing I should explain that's like not totally obvious in the picture is that the actual point in the system where the radiation is collected. So in the traditional radio telescope, this box has a feed or an antenna in it. And the light comes in, and it's reflected off the dish, and it bounces up to the feed. And analogously in CHIME, is there a laser pointer by any chance?
There's a hockey stick.
Hockey stick, yeah, okay, I forgot.
There should be.
That's okay, I'll just, I don't think I really need it. If you see a suspended above each cylinder, there's a feed line, which contains a bunch of antennas, 256 antennas, underneath the line. So the radiation is coming down from the sky and bouncing off of the cylinders and coming up to that central feed line where it's collected by not just one feed, but many feeds. Oh, okay, perfect, okay. So here's how the traditional telescope works. It focuses using physical delays. So the optics of the dish have been constructed in such a way that if this bundle of parallel rays comes in from infinity, that all of these path lengths are the same, the path length to the feed. And therefore, the radiation will interfere constructively, and the image will be magnified at the feed, or focused. But if this bundle of rays were coming in from a different direction off to the side, then the constructive interference condition would not be satisfied. You would get destructive interference at the feed. And that's why the dish is sensitive to one direction, but not others. Now, I want you to imagine getting rid of the dish, replacing it by a bunch of antennas, and simulating the dish in software. So what I mean by that is I get rid of this curved surface, and I just replace it by a bunch of antennas indicated by X's. And at each of those antenna locations, the antenna just measures the electric field and records it to a digital time stream, converts analog to digital. If you did have a dish here, all it would really be doing at like a microscopic level is combining those electric field measurements with some set of delays, different delay for each point on the surface. And so you could simulate that in software by taking all of your digital time streams, applying some delay or shift, and then adding them together. A traditional radio telescope, you would steer by mechanically pointing the dish in a different direction. But an instrument like this, so-called phased array interferometer, you would just change the delays in software, and you could point the dish in a different direction. You could focus it in software in a different part of the sky. And so you may be wondering what's gained by doing that. And what is gained is that because digital time streams may be copied freely, you can repeat this beamforming procedure, or that is applying some set of delays to the per antenna time streams and adding them together, for multiple points, for n points on the sky. So unlike a traditional telescope that can only point in one direction at once, we can double our sensitivity or statistical power just by making two copies of every time stream and combining the copies with different sets of delays. So this instrument can be n times more powerful than a so-called beamforming interferometer, where you just collect radiation and do a bunch of software tricks to form beams in different directions. Can be equivalent to n traditional telescopes all pointed in slightly different directions, where n is just the number of beams that you can afford to compute. So in CHIME, we have a 4 by 256 array of antennas. And we have the computing power and software methodology to form all 1,024 independent beams in real time. So it's sort of hard to believe, but it's actually true that this instrument is equivalent to 1,024 copies of a traditional single-feed telescope, all pointed in slightly different directions. By the way, the picture doesn't really do justice to the scale, but CHIME is 80 meters on a side, so it's like a couple of times bigger than Perimeter Institute, and its raw sensitivity is. Yeah, like each of these feed lines is a walkway that a person can walk on. And so its raw sensitivity is equivalent to 1,024 traditional radio telescopes, each with the same collecting area, the same 80 meter by 80 meter collecting area, which is the size of like a large research telescope. I'll say a little bit more just about the like beamforming process, just to give you a better sense for how this instrument works. So the CHIME design is actually a compromise between optical focusing and software focusing. In previous slides, I had drawn cartoons that just illustrated the two limits of pure optical focusing and pure software focusing. So the cylinder shape is focused in one axis and unfocused in the other. So if you only had a single antenna in the system, which would mean that there was no scope for beamforming, then the response of that antenna to the sky, or the so-called primary beam of the antenna, would be a strip where the cylinder is focusing in one direction, but unfocused in the other. Now, if you have many antennas, each of which is sensitive to that primary beam, then by taking delayed linear combinations of the different feeds, you can form 1,024 beams that each are sensitive to or focused on a little spot within the strip. Our instrument has no moving parts. It just sits on the ground, and this pattern of primary beam and formed beams is stationary. Except there's always one moving part that you get for free, and that's the Earth, which rotates. So if you think of the sky as being fixed and the Earth rotating, then this whole pattern of primary beam and formed beams sweeps out the whole northern sky every 24 hours. And so we get to make every 24 hours, we get to see the whole sky. We just don't get to choose instantaneously where we point. Motors are actually one of the most expensive, like high precision motors are actually one of the most expensive things about a telescope. So this saves us a lot of money. So every 24 hours, we make an image of the sky with an angular resolution around a third of a degree. That's the size of the formed beams in this particular frequency range, which happens to be interesting for a lot of different scientific purposes. So I want to show you the little back of the envelope calculation that I was doing a few years ago when I decided to get involved in this project. It was a little bit of a change of focus for me. Previous to CHIME, I was doing mostly cosmic microwave background science, which is a little different from radio astronomy. Of course, the tools are fairly transferable, but somewhat different subject. So from everything that I've said so far, you might assume that if you want to compare the statistical power of different telescopes, you could compute something called the mapping speed, which is the collecting area of the telescope, which determines the instantaneous sensitivity per beam. Multiplied by the number of beams, that would be one for a traditional telescope, or actually, for a traditional telescope, you can put a few feeds at the focus and get a few beams on the sky that are optically in focus. These numbers are not equal to one for the traditional pulse. Times some order one factors that I omitted for simplicity in this back of the envelope comparison, things like noise temperatures, system bandwidths, and so on. And so, and that's usually correct. This number, the mapping speed, for most things, determines just the total statistical power of a radio telescope. So with this, you know, slightly simplified definition and in some arbitrary units which are not what are actually used, here's CHIME compared to some other famous radio telescopes. You can see that its mapping speed is a little larger or comparable to the others. Now, I made this slide to show how ridiculous that actually is. So here's CHIME compared to SCALE to FAST, the second to last entry on the list. FAST is a 500-meter telescope in southwest China, which is really one of the biggest and most ambitious projects in astronomy. And here is CHIME, which is this little grassroots effort that we're making in British Columbia on, you know, a few percent, maybe 2% of the budget. It just seems too good to be true that this telescope can really be equivalent to this telescope just due to some software tricks. The comparison on the slide seems too simple to be wrong. So a few years ago, I was wondering, you know, can this really be right? What's going on? It seems too good to be true. There is a catch to this, and I'll tell you what it is in a few slides. But I decided first to just pause and tell you. So I described the telescope, and I explained that it has really high sensitivity or mapping speed because we have the strategy of forming a huge number of beams in software. I want to talk a little bit about the high-level science and what we hope to do with it. I'd say we have radio astronomy is a big subject, and in my view, there are three main high-level science goals of CHIME. I omitted some more minor specialized science goals just to keep the talk focused. So one thing that we would like to do is understand better the physics of dark energy. So dark energy is not a name that I really like, so let me just re-explain it from scratch and just say what the phenomenon is. So if the expansion history of the universe is measured between the Big Bang and now, between the Big Bang and now, space has expanded, so there's some function of time that tells you if you took a given length scale in the universe today, say 1 megaparsec, two objects at that separation would have a different separation at an earlier time. And so that separation as a function of time is what's plotted visually. Einstein's theory of relativity predicted an expansion, and more specifically, a decelerating expansion, so that the curve would look like this, roughly like a parabola. Since 1960 or so, it was expected that when this curve was measured, it would show a decelerating shape. In the early 90s, however, observational evidence on a variety of fronts really convinced everyone that what actually happened is that we had a decelerating expansion until a few billion years ago, and then the universe, you know, gradually switched over to an accelerating expansion. Dark energy is just sort of a catch-all term for your favorite modification of general relativity that would switch the sign of the expansion at some point in the history of the universe. There's a lot of this curve is sort of related to the question of how the universe will end. In an accelerating universe, the universe ends by in a state of accelerating expansion where things just get exponentially dilute. The distance between any two galaxies goes to infinity exponentially. All the matter in the universe dilutes out and the universe dies, so-called heat death. Kind of a depressing plot if you really think about it. So that's what we're trying to explain. And one theory for the mainstream theory for why this might be happening is that if you just slightly modify general relativity by assigning a small non-zero energy density to the vacuum, so-called cosmological constant, then it produces the right shape, and the details of that shape are consistent with the data that we've collected until now. But the data is also current data is not really all that constraining between different models, so the cosmological constant explanation may be wrong. It's not supposed to be obvious. You know, I make a lot of hand-waving statements that aren't supposed to be obvious. So it's not supposed to be obvious that assigning a non-zero energy density to the vacuum would make the universe accelerate. But if you put it into the equations of general relativity, that is what happens. What general relativity predicts is that the total expansion rate should be proportional to the total energy density of the universe, or more precisely, the square root of the total energy density. So it's the matter in the universe that's driving the expansion. The more matter or the more total energy there is in the universe, the faster the universe expands. And what would happen for ordinary matter, like atoms, is that as the universe expands, its density dilutes. And so you get a decelerating expansion since the density is going down with time and there's less stuff to drive the expansion. What happens with the cosmological constant is that the energy density of the universe stays, the energy per cubic meter stays fixed, so that as the universe expands, there's more energy to drive the expansion faster, and you get a runaway exponential growth. So time, it turns out, can be really good at measuring the expansion history. Just to say a little bit about how we do it, the next two slides are probably a little too technical. Sorry about that. The rest of the talk is better. Neutral hydrogen, there's some neutral hydrogen hanging around in like gas clouds and galaxies. Neutral hydrogen has a long-lived spectral line at a wavelength of 21 centimeters or a frequency of 1420 megahertz. And so you see, if you had a very sensitive radio telescope, you could see galaxies at a frequency which is given by the rest frequency of the line, 1420 megahertz, with some multiplicative correction depending on how far away the galaxy is, the redshift. So here's a little cartoon where I have this radio telescope looking through a galaxy at a cosmological distance at redshift 1, another galaxy farther away in the spectrum along that line of sight would show two bumps. By doing this at in every direction, we can make like a 2D map, and by letting the frequency be the radial coordinate, we can make a 3D map of all of the neutral hydrogen in the universe. This map just showing the cartoon on the previous slide is kind of exaggerated since we don't actually resolve individual galaxies with high signal to noise. But we get a really noisy, low-resolution map of the neutral hydrogen density throughout the universe. By statistically analyzing this map, measurements of the expansion history usually derive from some sort of statistical analysis of where galaxies are. And so through a statistical analysis of this map, the expansion history can actually be reconstructed really well. But explaining the details of how you do statistics on this map to get this curve would be a big digression. I'd have to tell you about something called baryonic acoustic oscillations, which would not the direction I want to go with the talk. Science goal number two, which is actually what I've mainly been working on, even though I'm a cosmologist, I got interested in this question instead with my students and postdocs here at PI. I'm going to say that about every 20 years or so, there's like a new explosion in outer space that no one expected to see makes all the astrophysicists freak out and try to explain. Like in the 80s and 90s, it was gamma ray bursts. And the 21st century mysterious explosion is something called a fast radio burst. So very occasionally, we see a brief, very intense pulse of radio waves originating at a cosmological distance, like billions of light years. It was a surprise, and we still don't know what physics produces these bursts. Over time, the question has really sharpened, and I would say it's become like a really central unsolved problem in astrophysics. There's some random articles from the popular press. Just to get a sense for what the fast radio burst or an FRB looks like in our data, here's a real FRB. This is actually not from CHIME. This is from the Parkes telescope. The FRB is a brief pulse, but the pulse is dispersed, which means that the arrival time of the pulse depends on the radio frequency where you observe. So this is a broadband system that measures, like CHIME, that measures a range of frequencies. And if you divide the data up into frequency channels, you can see that the pulse arrives with a delay which is proportional to frequency to the max. That functional form of the arrival delay on the frequency is called the dispersion relation. And the minus two exponent is what you naturally get if the pulse just passes through a bunch of free electrons, a bunch of ionized electrons before it returns. If the electrons are sufficiently cold and unmagnetized, you get an exponent of minus two. So what was interesting about the fast radio burst is, so like this happens whenever a pulsar goes off in our galaxy, for example. But what was interesting, you get this dispersed pulse, and the amount of dispersion is related to just the total number of electrons between us and the pulsar. But what was interesting about the fast radio burst is that they had very high dispersion, suggesting a larger electron count than could be explained from the electrons that are in our galaxy. And so a natural explanation was to suppose that they were at like a really enormous distance, like a cosmological distance, in order to build up enough electrons between us and the burst to explain the total dispersion. And so understanding the origin of these ultra-distant pulses, and now it's really established that the FRBs do come from cosmological distances. So we know that they're very far away, which means that since they're still bright enough to see, they must be incredibly bright in the actual rest frame of the burst. And so understanding the origin of these violent events has become a really, really important unsolved problem in astrophysics. So when we were doing forecasts before we had any data or anything, we just anticipated that Chime would have an incredibly high FRB rate. We would find significantly more FRBs than all other radio telescopes in the world combined, which is a really strong statement. In a few slides, I'll show you how we're actually doing. Here's like my theory slide. I don't want to say, theoretical physicists are really good at coming up with like hundreds of alternative explanations for an unexplained phenomenon. And I just can't do justice to the variety of models that have been proposed to explain fast radio bursts, except to say that people actually write cataloging papers for theories just to keep everything straight. So if you're the intended audience for a paper like this is experimenters that are trying to understand, if you make some new observation about an FRB or there's some new statistical analysis you can do, how does that help you constrain the different theoretical possibilities? So there are tables that you can try to look up. I saw a correlation between how wide the burst is and how dispersed it is. But there's a table you can look at that will sort of tell you what the implications are for this.
So why did they choose alien light sails versus like some other alien transmitter to do
that? That's on the list, isn't it? Alien light sails. Don't put me in the position of defending this paper. I can't. I don't know which of these explanations are right, but the alien light sails is not the way that I would bet.
What do the types here mean? Like single, both,
So this is later in the talk, but I forgot to say it in this part. So at the time, let me right now just talk about the observational situation before Chime, because I don't want to ruin the surprise where I talk about the Chime results. But before Chime, the situation was that about 50 FRBs had been observed. And one of the FRBs had been found to repeat. And it repeats quite a lot. So there have been a few hundred pulses now observed from that single object, the repeater. The repetition is sort of sporadic, like lightning. Like sometimes it'll repeat a lot, and then it'll be quiet for a while. And the other FRBs had had never been observed to repeat. As far as we knew, they just pulsed once and then were like dead forever. Despite a ton of telescope time spent staring at positions of previously observed FRBs to look for repeats. So it was actually sort of weird that there was this one object that repeated all the time and the other FRBs did not. Suggesting perhaps that there are actually two types of object. There's a historical precedent, actually, which is that when gamma ray bursts were found, the historical story of how gamma ray bursts were found is kind of fun. There were gamma ray, the first gamma ray telescopes were launched in like the 70s or 80s to enforce nuclear test ban treaties. So that when you know, if the Soviet Union were to test a nuclear weapon, then that produces a bunch of gamma rays that would show up in some spy satellite in orbit. But they found that there seemed to be an awful lot of nuclear weapons going off in space, like when the telescope was pointed away from the Earth. And apparently the military knew about this phenomenon for a long time, but waited for a while to tell the astronomers. When the astronomers found out, there was this new phenomenon to explain. Anyway, GRBs, gamma ray bursts, are now understood to be just two distinct types of phenomena. You get a gamma ray burst when two neutron stars merge, and you also sometimes get a gamma ray burst when a supernova goes off. And they produce gamma ray bursts with slightly different characteristics. But apparently, it's historically, a historical lesson is that the field of gamma ray bursts was held up for a long time by theorists being really stubborn about thinking that there was only one type of gamma ray burst, and trying to come up with models that explained both populations at once. So it could be the case that there's just two unrelated reasons why you get a pulse of radio waves from cosmological distance, giving rise to repeaters and non-repeaters. So we may be, in searching for an explanation for the fast radio bursts, we may be looking for just one explanation, or we may be looking for two. That's kind of an unsolved problem, whether the repeaters and the non-repeaters are the same type of object. The third science goal, I would say, which is what I've been working on very recently, is searching for new pulsars with CHIME. Pulsar, I found this cartoon. So a pulsar is a rapidly spinning magnetized neutron star with a narrow beam. And if the geometry is right, then we see the pulses when they sweep over the Earth, like the same way a ship sees a lighthouse. Pulsars are really interesting objects. Like favorite application for pulsars is just to use them. So pulsars are incredibly accurate clocks. They're stable to one part in a trillion. If you imagine that nature has provided you with a network of incredibly accurate clocks all over the galaxy, then you can use that as a device for doing all sorts of interesting things, including looking for gravity waves. So when a gravity wave goes through this picture, as everyone has heard, the LIGO experiment finds gravity waves by comparing light travel times between two arms of an interferometer. When a gravity wave goes through the interferometer, length of the interferometer is slightly dilated in one direction and contracted in the other, so that the light travel times become slightly different. And the same thing happens in this picture. When a gravity wave goes through our galaxy, it'll systematically advance pulsar arrival times in some directions and delay them in others. And so you can monitor these pulsars, monitor their timing, and use the network of pulsars as a giant gravitational wave telescope to look for gravity waves that come from outside the galaxy. So gravity waves have not yet been detected this way. They have been detected with laser interferometers like LIGO. So due to its high mapping speed, CHIME had amazing forecasts in several areas of cosmology and astrophysics. It's also a really inexpensive project. We could do the whole thing in Canada without international partners. $15 million is actually a small number compared to what a new research telescope usually costs nowadays. They're usually $100 million to $1 billion. So we were wondering a few years ago whether this was all too good to be true. And now I'm going to tell you why this is really hard. I wasn't quite smart enough to see this problem coming. But if I had been a little smarter, I might have chickened out and not worked on it. And I'm glad that I wasn't smart enough. Previously, I put this table up, and I was multiplying the collecting area of the telescope by the number of beams that it forms to get the mapping speed or some measure of the statistical power. That is indeed true if you interpret this rightmost column as statistical power in principle under the assumption of unlimited computing power. But the challenge with CHIME is that the total sensitivity is diluted. If you're just trying to maximize A times N, then increasing A is really expensive. You have to like build a huge dish. You have to like get a bunch of steel and reinforce things, and it gets expensive really fast. If you want to increase N, you just buy more computers, and computers are like really cheap nowadays. We use really like cheap commodity computing equipment, like graphics cards, GPUs that you can just buy off Amazon. We're kind of leveraging the video game industry, I guess, which has really provided us with this amazing technology for really cheap. So if you're just trying to maximize this product, it's way more efficient to increase N. But the problem with that is that now you have an instrument with very low sensitivity per beam, where your sensitivity is diluted across this huge amount of data. The total amount of data that the instrument generates is proportional to N. So this isn't, the time strategy is not a strategy for getting something for nothing. It's like a strategy of moving difficulty from hardware to software. We're saying that instead of like confronting the challenge of building this gigantic dish, we're going to build something like inexpensive that generates a huge amount of data, and then confront hard problems later in software. And so to quantify those problems better, so I think of Chime as like this software telescope where the actual like physical telescope itself is kind of inexpensive and low tech, and like all of the magic happens in the computers. So to quantify the computational problems a little bit better, I want to draw a little system diagram to show you how this software telescope computes. So the signals come in off the telescope in a bunch of analog coax cables. And the first thing that happens is that they go through a bunch of very specialized computers that take those, and also some amplifiers and other things that aren't on, that take those analog signals and convert them to digital, and also do a little bit of signal processing, like splitting the signal up into frequency channels. And the total data rate at this point in the system, I should say that every box in this diagram is going to be like one supercomputer that we had to, like collectively Chime is one of the largest supercomputers in Canada, that we had to build from scratch in a shipping container in a pretty remote location. It's like a DIY supercomputer. So the raw data rate at this point in the system is 800 gigabytes per second. Which is comparable to, like, just to put that number in perspective, comparable to like the total cell phone traffic in North America, or a few percent of the global internet. The global internet is something like 40 terabytes per second. But we're processing this data, you know, not with a global communications network, but in some shipping containers in a valley in British Columbia, which is kind of crazy. So from there it goes in, the data goes to this huge GPU farm, which we call the correlator, and then we have other specialized supercomputers that are all doing one thing, that request a different data product over the network from the correlator. The philosophy here of the software telescope is that if you want to do something new, like search for FRBs, at one point this box didn't exist, like the cosmology backend was built first. Instead of building a new telescope, you already have this digital system that's like digitized the sky. So instead of building a new telescope, you just ask this, this supercomputer to form some new data product, write some new software, and then build some new computers to search for FRBs. So for example, each of these backends is asking the correlator for to compute a different thing. So for example, the pulsar timing backend wants to know, so the purpose of this backend is to monitor the timing of pulsars that have already been found. At any instantaneous time, there might be up to 10, say, pulsars in the Chime primary beam. And what the pulsar timing backend wants to know is, it asks the correlator, for each of these 10 points that I specify, give me as much information as you can about the sky. So give me the digitized electric field at nanosecond sampling. That's the fastest rate we can sample the electric field. If you're searching for FRBs, then you might be interested in the FRB backend. Might be interested in more sky locations. So we look for FRBs in all 1,024 formed beams. But less information per beam. So we ask for the intensity, which is obtained from the electric field with some downsample by squaring and applying some downsampling factors. And at a lower time resolution at millisecond sampling. there's a total bandwidth constraint that has to be satisfied, just because it's only practical to run so many network cables and have so many computers. So the Pulsar timing backend needs more information at fewer sky locations. FRB backend has more sky locations, but less information. And so the computational challenges of CHIME are really insane compared to what's usually done in radio astronomy. For example, when we got into the FRB search, which I'll sort of concentrate on because this is what I personally worked on. So we learned that we were trying to do an FRB search that was 200 times larger in data volume than any previously performed search. So this is like roughly how much we had to speed the software up by. The biggest challenge, I won't talk about it very much in the talk because it's just way too technical, but what we actually spent most of our time on was the problem of separating FRBs from human-made radio signals, radio frequency interference. So a cell phone, a kilometer, humans generate a ton of radio waves. A cell phone, a kilometer from a radio telescope is brighter than the sun. So in our raw data, if you didn't do any filtering, we're just completely dominated by all of the digital TV stations and cell phone traffic, and there's a road that isn't perfectly shielded by the mountains of the valley, and so when someone drives by using their phone, or maybe in the parking lot of the building when someone uses the a keyless entry system for their car, we get events in our telescope that can look a lot like FRBs. So we had to separate them because we have so much data. It's easy to lose the FRBs in the forest of false positives from human-made radio transmissions. We had to do a better job on this classification problem by roughly a factor of 1,000. We had to do the whole thing in real time while the data is in a moving memory window, which was sort of new. And finally, there's the challenge of building a supercomputer from scratch on a pretty modest budget with limited infrastructure to actually run this. So the question of whether instrument like FAST is really equivalent to CHIME is a complicated question. It depends on whether some hard computing problems can be solved. And this is really the research program that we were undertaking with CHIME. That's our software telescope. And in the next few parts of the talk, I'll talk about how it went and how we're currently doing. I'll concentrate on the FRBs because the actual search software that finds the FRBs in this very large data volume was written here at Permit. So I thought that this would not be that hard. I thought that it would take two people a few months, and it took six people about 3 years. Fun fact: Maya was at ISSYP 2016, and she came to Perimeter between high school and university. And did some really high-powered, interesting work on the CHIME real-time search. How many people here are familiar with a low-level programming language like C++? Oh, wow, that's great. Okay. I thought that it was sort of like a lost art nowadays, since high-level languages like Python are getting so powerful and ubiquitous. But if you want to write really fast code, here's some code to take the transpose of an n by n matrix, then you'll want to use a low-level language like C++, where everything is explicitly typed and there's sort of a transparent one-to-one mapping between compiled mapping between lines in your code and assembly language instructions. When I started working on this problem, I had thought that if you wanted to write the fastest possible code, that this is roughly what it would look like. But there's a way to do it which is significantly faster, but takes significantly more human time. So I'll show you an equivalent transpose function, which is four times faster.
Nice.
And this would have been incomprehensible to me a few years ago. So it turns out that if you want to be the human compiler, then you can beat the compiler by, it totally depends on what you're specifically you're doing. But in this case, this implementation is four times faster. It turns out that modern CPUs are vectorized, meaning that they have fat registers that store, in this case, for the CPUs we use in CHIME, 8 floating point numbers at once. And there's some sort of constrained set of instructions for shuffling data around between those fat registers. So what this implementation is doing is reading out the matrix in like 8x8 blocks and doing this sequence of shuffling operations before writing out the transpose matrix in an 8x8 block, which the compiler doesn't seem to be able to find. I've tried. But if you read this like big Intel optimization algorithm and learn the rules of the game, then it actually, once you get some practice, it becomes a semi-mechanical process to write code like this. I show these slides just for like novelty value. I basically never recommend that you do this, since if you imagine like writing a whole program this way, then you're always going to come out ahead if you don't spend that human time and just let the computer compute 4 times longer. Unless you're in the situation of building a supercomputer from scratch to just run one program for 5 years, then it makes sense. I'll talk a little bit. These next few slides are really technical, but I want to talk a little bit about like what we actually do when we when I say we went, 6 people went off for 3 years and wrote software. What we're actually doing. We have some new search algorithms for finding FRBs that are really powerful. So to give sort of a qualitative idea of how they work, I want to consider a problem which is not the FRB search problem, but contains the key computational trick. So imagine that you're given a large rectangular or two-dimensional array of numbers, and you want to sum the array over all possible straight lines. I haven't defined the problem perfectly, since I haven't exactly specified how this straight line maps onto this discrete array. But part of the problem, let's say part of the problem is to come up with a scheme of your choice for approximating the straight line by some irregular jagged sequence of samples. Here's a really fast way to do it on the computer. So this is going to be like a recursive tree algorithm. So you could start by taking this array and forming all vertical sums and all diagonal sums. So the color coding in these slides is supposed to tell you how. Let me first say that. I form all vertical sums, meaning pairs of elements that are related vertically, and I put those in a subarray, a child array, and then I form all diagonal sums, which are pairs of elements related diagonally, like this, and I put those in a child array. The total number of vertical sums is, you know, half the number of elements in the original array. So this array is half the size of the input, and this array is also half the size. So the total data volume is preserved here. And the color coding in these slides is supposed to help you keep track of how each element in a child or shortly grandchild array corresponds to some sum of elements in its ancestor. In the next slide, I'm going to do exactly the same operation recursively on each of these child arrays to get grandchildren. So in each child array, I form all vertical sums and all diagonal sums. The color coding now is telling you that this element of the grandchild array corresponded to this sum of elements in the child array and this sum of elements in the root. So you can see that in the root, I'm starting to build up these straight lines that I want to sum over. In the last iteration of the tree algorithm, I formed great grandchild arrays. Now each of these arrays corresponds to a line with some slope in the original input. And the one-dimensional axis here corresponds to the overall offset. So it turns out that this implementation is really fast. If you think about the computational cost, so I claim that the computational cost of this tree algorithm is proportional to like xy log y, where x and y are the number of elements on these two axes. Whereas a brute force algorithm, if you didn't know about any of this, and you were just summing by brute force over all of these straight lines, then the computational cost would be xy squared, or proportional to xy squared. And for us, in Chime, the y here is a number like 30,000. So we really save a lot by replacing one factor of y by its log. this tree algorithm is sort of reusing computations, like in, you know, a particular element of a grandchild array would correspond to a sum of four elements, which is used twice and doesn't need to be recomputed from scratch both times. So there's a lot more, you know, I sort of struggle to create slides that really convey the difficulty of the problems we were trying to solve without getting too bogged down in technical details. I mean, let me also say that I think the reason we underestimated how long it would take is that when you're trying to get this huge speed up, there's a whole bunch of like low level stuff that you have to write from scratch, which normally doesn't happen in computing. Like if you want to make a fast website, well, someone has already written a fast web server for you, and you just have to supply like the HTML and JavaScript. For us, it's like we had to write, like each of these nodes that's searching for FRBs is actually a little server that has to ingest data at a really high rate. And like Chime is really like the heterogeneous data center. And we had to write sort of the server front end from scratch. It's like, imagine that you have to implement a data center and there's really no existing software ecosystem at your disposal. You just have like your only tools like C++ compiler. It took forever. Yeah?
So wasn't there like any parts that were taken from other data centers? So all of it was from scratch, all of the software?
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. Because it just had to be so much faster. Okay. So now in the next part of the talk, which is the most fun, I would say, I'm going to talk about, so while we were doing all this, a lot was happening on site. So I'll talk about the sort of timeline of the project and where we currently stand. So it was really fun to make these slides because 2013 wasn't that long ago. And the slides really reminded me of how much progress we've actually made. So the earliest mention of Chime that I could find in the press was from 2013, where I don't know why they included this photo, since this is just the field where Chime is going to be. There's nothing in the picture. But here's where we stood in 2013. We had an empty field and like a name for the project. But 2015, we had built the Chime Pathfinder. So we started with like a 1/10 scale version of Chime. Just to sort of debug engineering problems, which I think was a really good idea. We learned a lot by building the Pathfinder. It's currently turned off once the full Chime was complete. There really wasn't much reason to keep paying the electric bill for the Pathfinder. But here's the Chime Pathfinder in this aerial photo. You can see the Chime Pathfinder is pretty big, right? Like these are people. Here's the Chime Pathfinder, and here's the square where full Chime eventually ended up. But 2017, full Chime was complete, this four-cylinder system. Here's Kirsty Duncan, the Canadian science minister at the ribbon-cutting ceremony in 2017. Now, while all this was happening, and so all of this, you know, is really built from scratch. I mean, there's a lot of commodity parts that you can order, like the, and we did use contractors, like, for the metal frame, the actual, like, frame of the telescope was built by a contracting company that builds supermarkets, if I remember right. This telescope has, you can't see in the picture, but the antennas, for example, were designed from scratch by Mei Ling Dang, a really good grad student at UBC. All of the amplifiers and were designed from scratch. There's so much cabling here. There's like a few hundred kilometers of cable in the system that has to be like pulled through cable trays by hand. So there's just like a beehive of people working at the site all the time. Can you see in this picture? Most of the complexity of the system is in computers, which are in these little shipping containers. Like you can see a little white box poking out here. There are five shipping containers current. We're building a sixth search for pulsars now. Five shipping containers full of computers on the site. One of the biggest challenges actually is just figuring out how to cool these computers. So normally if you wanted to build a big room full of computers, a machine room, then what you would do is just like put fans in the computer so that they exchange heat with the ambient air, and then put a big fan or like an air conditioner, cut a hole in the side, put a big fan or an air conditioner to exhaust heat into the environment. You know, we have this problem that computers generate a huge amount of radio waves. So this is like having a spotlight next to the telescope. So the so this shipping container is not a normal shipping container. It's been like engineered to be radio wave leak proof. Like it's really serious. It's like a battleship. It's got these big like metal plates. And there's like a little airlock with like two really heavy doors with like a this like really intense latching mechanism that you have to go through. And so the only way that we could cool them is through like a water cooling system. So the only concession we can make to cooling is to have like one pipe that carries cold water in and another pipe that carries hot water out. And then inside the shipping container, let me show a picture of the inside. So inside the shipping container, it's like a little server room in there. There are all these, in addition to like, you know, network cables, which are normal, there are these cables full of water, which is kind of a, computers plus water is like not always the best combination. We had one leak incident. And it turns out the plumbing was actually, like there's lots of pumps that have to circulate the water. And it turns out that we were really bad at plumbing. It was like one of the most challenging parts of the project. It really gave me like a great new respect for plumbers. What they do is really hard. There were several months that where our hardware telecons were just a bunch of theoretical physicists trying to figure out why some pump wasn't working or the pressure was too high or something. It actually kind of seriously delayed the project. By the way, I really didn't work on any of this stuff. While all of this was happening, I was back here in my office writing the software that was going to power this thing. So just between you and me, when you have like a first light ceremony for a software telescope, what that means is that all of the the physical telescope is complete, but all of our software was still being debugged. It actually was kind of stressful to like, you know, in my office, like things aren't working. It's like I don't know how to fix it, trying to figure out how we're going to make it work. And then I'll take a break and look at the news, and then this is happening. It's like kind of, it does create a lot of pressure. Here are some of the computers we use. This is the FPGA board, which is actually like a custom board. This is the one part of the Chime system, which is like custom electronics that was designed and built from scratch specifically for Chime. This is the very first part of the system that's bringing in analog signals on coaxial cables, digitizing it, doing a little bit of signal processing, and then putting it out on 10 gigabit Ethernet, a common network fabric, so that it can be processed by like ordinary computers. Here's an amplifier that I just put in for fun. Most of the computers in Chime are just like normal commodity, like workstation type hardware. Actually, not even workstation type hardware, more like gamer type hardware that we just buy from Amazon and put these computers together ourselves. The only thing that is kind of unusual about these computers is that everything is water cooled. Like, here's an FRB search node, and you can see it has two CPUs, and you can see the water cooling. Fun fact, today is the 1 year anniversary of the first FRB we detected. This was very exciting, so exactly 1 year ago. Here's our baby, here's the baby picture, we turned one today. We detected our first fast radio burst. It was actually, I would say, sort of a typical fast radio burst, but it was incredibly exciting to see this pop out. I was on a flight at the time, and when I landed, there was just this like, my email was just like overflowing. So that was in July, and then by late August, we had found 13 FRBs. At the time, we were still, so the total number found by all their telescopes is 52. So that's pretty good. And we were still actually sort of debugging things, and like we were installing computers during this time interval. So like the number of beams on the sky was growing as a function of time during this window. And it took us, it actually took us a few months to finalize papers on these 13 events. The data analysis is, we were actually just focusing so much on getting the system to work that we were really underprepared with in terms of data analysis tools. We published these two papers, which got a huge amount of attention. You're on the cover of Nature, which is cool. The amount of press attention we got was like really amazing. I was really surprised. This slide doesn't even do justice to like the number of articles in the popular press that appeared. Most of which even reported it responsibly and didn't say we found aliens. So there's a lot to say about our FRBs, and I'll just say a few things. So one thing that's sort of unique about our data is that it goes down to lower frequencies than previous observations. So previously, almost all the FRBs were detected at a frequency of around 1.4 gigahertz. That just happens to be a frequency that is used very frequently in radio astronomy because it's the frequency of the neutral hydrogen line that I mentioned when I was talking about cosmology. And FRB surveys at lower frequencies hadn't been very successful, which was a big like question mark for us when doing our forecasts. So we were kind of worried about this. So a few had been found, chime surveys from 400 to 800 megahertz, and a few had been found at 800 megahertz. So we knew that we would see some. The number that we would see was not V0. But all searches between the planning of CHIME and our actual FRB search, there were a lot of unsuccessful searches at low frequency, which was making us nervous. In fact, all searches below 200 megahertz have been unsuccessful. And so including like some really strong cases. Like there was a case of a co-observation of an incredibly bright FRB in the ASCAP telescope at 1.4 gigahertz, where the same part of the sky was simultaneously observed at 185 megahertz with a different telescope, the MWA. And even though the event was like incredibly bright at 1.4 gigahertz, nothing was seen at 185 megahertz. And so there are claims from before CHIME. There are claims that there's some sort of cutoff in the spectrum of the FRBs, so that they're just absent at low frequencies, like completely gone by the time you get to 200, but ubiquitous at 1 gigahertz or so. But we don't see any evidence for that. Our FRBs we have about as many FRBs that are bright at 400 as we do FRBs that are bright at 800. Like many of our FRBs are like, you know, their spectrum is getting brighter as you go to lower frequencies, and it's still going up at 400. It's really unclear what's going on. I actually don't really know how to reconcile the CHIME observations with the previous observations that suggested this presence of this cutoff. Well, you're probably wondering, well, why can't there just be a sharp cutoff between 400 and 200? That's allowed by the data, but I think it's sort of hard to think of a physical mechanism that would produce such a cutoff. So I don't know what's going on there. In our first 13 events, we found a new repeating FRB. I mentioned previously that before CHIME, one of the FRBs was a repeater, which is now called R1. It used to be called the repeater, but now there's more than one. It's much better studied than the non-repeating FRBs. Because you know where it is, you can point every telescope in the world there, wait for it to go off, and just accumulate a huge amount of information. For example, using a technique called VLBI interferometry that I'll explain in a few slides, the host galaxy has been determined, and we know exactly how far away it is. We know that it is indeed at a cosmological distance, like everyone thought. So this repeater, R1, was found relatively early. It repeats a lot, but no other FRB had ever been observed to repeat, despite a lot of telescope time spent trying. So the situation was getting a little weird. So in our first month, in our first 13 events, we did find a new repeating FRB. Here are five pulses from our repeater, which is called R2. Here's an interesting plot. So the original repeater had this particular structure. I forgot to say that when I show these plots of the FRB, the axes of the plot are time and frequency, but the dispersion has been corrected. So if you didn't correct the dispersion, then this event would be spread out over, like in CHIME, would be spread out over like 10 seconds or 10,000 milliseconds And it's only after correcting for that dispersion delay that you can make a plot of what the pulse would look like in the rest frame of the FRB with no dispersion applied. So anyway, you can see that like the repeater is not really one pulse. It has a few subpulses and they march downward in frequency. And that was sort of, you know, something that was curious that had attracted a lot of speculation. And so it was really interesting that in our repeater we saw the same, at least in one of the pulses, we saw the same sort of structure. This is actually, the theorists have models that can explain this. If you have some sort of like relativistic shock, like let's say a magnetar flares and produces a whole bunch of electrons whose velocity is comparable to the speed of light, and that flare runs into some matter, say it could be the electrons from a supernova remnant that surround the magnetar. Then when the flare decelerates through the matter, then for complicated plasma physics reasons that I never actually learned about, it's just a paper that I need to read, I haven't read it yet, it produces this downward marching structure where as the shock decelerates and becomes non-relativistic, the peak frequency shifts to a lower value. So that was in August. So now we found, before I show the next few slides, I should explain like the culture of secrecy that surrounds these big experiments. So it seemed a little strange when I first heard about it, but it makes sense. So if you ask me questions about these slides, I probably have to say, I'm sorry, that's classified information, I can't tell you. We try to avoid publicizing information before our papers are out. Not because we want to keep it secret, but because we want to make sure that everyone in the collaboration has a chance to comment and check everything and make sure that everything is correct before someone else in the experiment represents the collaboration by making statements. So I have permission from the collaboration to show just a few specific slides, and I have to be kind of mysterious about the details. So I can say that. As of today, in July, we found over 500 fast radio bursts. We found multiple repeating FRBs. This table showing six repeater candidates is actually out of date, but I don't have permission to show the up-to-date one. We have a paper that's coming out like very soon, probably this week, that has a current snapshot of our catalog of repeating FRBs. I will say that like a couple weeks ago, my student Masood told me that he found a new repeating FRB over the weekend in our data, and I said like, "Oh, cool," and changed the subject. Like it's not a big deal anymore, which is wild. A year ago, there was only one now. So we have a ton of analysis papers in progress to appear starting the next few weeks, and I imagine continuing for a few years. I mean, we're really sort of center stage in the field. We're by far the most powerful telescope for finding these FRBs. We're really just crushing the FRB search problem. So if going back to this slide, I think we've shown that a modest instrument like Chime, through some really cutting edge software tricks, can be equivalent to a billion-dollar telescope like FAST. But what about pulsars and cosmology? I outlined all of these science goals for Chime, and I've talked about the FRBs, and that's just because we finished that first. So for these other problems also depend on solving really hard computational or statistics, data analysis problems, and we happened to get the FRB system working first. And then it really got the spotlight because a year later we have all these amazing results. These other hard problems, we're still working on in the background. I'm actually spending more time now working on pulsar, trying to set up software for a pulsar search than I am on data analysis of our FRBs. I want to just conclude by saying a little bit about those problems and what we're doing next. We have this software telescope design that was like really ambitious. I think You know, the reason that we did it first is that we were the first ones who were sort of willing to go for it. It wasn't like obvious that it was going to work in advance. It's kind of a high-risk project. That has really tremendous sensitivity at a small fraction of the cost of building a normal telescope. But it has this enormous data rate, and achieving this in-principle sensitivity depends on solving these really hard computing problems. Now, computing problems you can hope to solve once and then just establish some software that will make it easy for other people to solve those problems. And so we sort of see Chime as like a test bed for developing software that can power this new generation of differently designed radio telescopes. And I think that we've really succeeded in doing this for the FRB search problem. For finding FRBs, we've shown that it can work. And for these other problems, like the pulsar search and the cosmology, we're currently working on it. And I would say the cosmology is in a fairly advanced stage. The pulsar search is like not quite had enough people working on it. But I'm actually really optimistic that we can do an amazing job on the pulsar search. So we hope that Chime is the first step toward a new, more powerful way of doing radio astronomy. Here are some things that we're currently working on. So here's one thing that I'm really excited about. So we plan to build outrigger telescopes, which are like smaller versions of Chime, maybe 1/10 the size or so, that are far away, so that locations and even the number haven't been determined yet. But in a few years, you know, Chime may look something like this, where there's the Chime core and then some small outriggers with 1/10 the collecting area scattered over North America. The reason this is really interesting is that so one thing I didn't talk about is like angular resolution. I sort of quantified the power of Chime by one number, the event rate, or just the number of FRBs that we see. But then there's also the question of how accurately you localize them on the sky. And our angular resolution is like not that great. It's like maybe a third of a degree, or you can do a little better with some fancy data analysis techniques. When an FRB goes off, and you draw a box around that FRB with our angular resolution or our uncertainty on that location, there are like hundreds of galaxies usually in the box, and you don't know which galaxy it came from. So these outriggers can, through use of outriggers, we can improve our angular resolution by a factor of something like 100,000, which would be enough to tell like which galaxy it's in, exactly which part of the galaxy it went off, whether there's other interesting stuff nearby, which is like super informative. Now, it might not be obvious why that's true, why adding these faraway telescopes improves your angular resolution so much. And roughly the reason why is that the way you get angular resolution in radio astronomy is through light travel times. So by comparing the arrival time of a burst here and here, we can figure out, you know, if you imagine moving the FRB on the sky, it would change the light travel delay between these two locations. And the angular resolution that you get turns out to be, if we space them really far apart, we become really sensitive to that angle. The angular resolution of the radio telescope is roughly the wavelength of the light, which for us is like half a meter, divided by the angular separation. So at a separation of like a few thousand kilometers, we can get down to, you know, something like 10 to the minus 6 radians, which is a lot better than we're doing now. I forgot to say, so like the reason why this is hard to do and why most people don't do it is that I explained that the main challenge of Chime is just processing the huge data volume. There's no way that requires all the data to be in one place. Like there's no way we could send all of our data across North America. That's like what the cell phone companies do. We're like a much smaller organization than the North American telecommunications industry. For an FRB, what you can do is you can, so it's not obvious how you're going to gather all of this data in the same location to analyze it all at once. But for an FRB, what you can do is have a triggered system where this outrigger is just saving its data in a moving window with ring buffer. And then when we detect an FRB in the core, we send a message to the outrigger that tells it, okay, we saw an FRB at this particular sky location at this time with this dispersion. Just save the part of your data that corresponds to that FRB, that like 1 millisecond window. We'll save it to disk and then trickle it out over the internet so that all the data can be brought to the same place. So the outriggers are actually throwing away like 99.999% of their data, and we only ever save the data when an FRB goes on. Yeah?
By doing that with the method you just pointed out, how many kind of bursts would you lose if they were to arrive at the outriggers first? How large is that window?
We hope to save the data for every FRB that's detected by the flow. And it's okay if the pulse arrives first at the outrigger.
Okay.
Because we'd have a memory buffer with some.
Okay.
The light travel time between here and here is, you know, something on the order of like tens of milliseconds. So it's no problem to add enough memory to remember that one. So the time design has inspired a bunch of follow-up experiments. In particular, Perimeter Institute is involved in Hyrax, which is this like a South African version of Chime that changes some things. This is an artist's rendition of what Hyrax will look like. Hyrax is currently like five dishes in the field. So Hyrax is similar to Chime, but a few things are different. Like Hyrax is using an array of dishes instead of a few cylinders. Hyrax will have outrigger telescopes from the very beginning. It's also in the southern hemisphere, which is actually like a little bit of a more fun hemisphere than the northern hemisphere, astronomically speaking. The galactic center is there. Most of the galaxy is there. There are a lot more pulsars in the south. So Hyrax will have four times the collecting area of Chime and four times, which gives rise to four times the mapping speed. And the budget is even though the mapping speed is higher, the budget is roughly the same as Chime, just because computers have gotten faster, like you have Moore's Law helping you. If you were to double the size of Chime, or double the size of Hyrax, then you would have twice the collecting area and twice the number of beams, so you'd have 16 times Chime mapping speed. So there's this very clear path of scaling up the Chime technology to instruments that are, you know, 10 to 100 times more powerful without being prohibitively expensive or complex. In Canada, we're doing a follow-up project called CORD, where we're, now that we have a little more time to reflect and a little more experience, we're rethinking a lot of aspects of Chime. Like, we're figuring out how to build different antennas. I didn't show the Chime antennas, but they are like clover leaves that look pretty different from this. We're figuring out how to build these antennas that can measure a much wider bandwidth with lower noise. We're experimenting with these fiberglass dishes that are probably a little cheaper per square meter of collecting area. So CORD is currently, by showing you these two plots, I've currently shown you the entire CORD project. It's like one dish in a lab at DRAO and one antenna in a lab at University of Toronto. But 2022, we hope to have a project that has roughly 10 times the mapping speed of Chime. So that's what I really think is fun about this, is it's like establishing the tools to take radio astronomy in a direction where it has 10 or 100 times the sensitivity in a few years. I think this subject's really, really exciting. It is sort of an unusual moment in the history of a subject like radio astronomy, where there's it may scale up by a few orders of magnitude in the very near future. And there's a lot of things to explore, like some milestones that are coming up are the use of radio telescopes or the 21 centimeter line for precision cosmology, much better measurements of pulsars that should help us find gravity waves and do other fun tests of general relativity. And finally, exploring the mystery of the fast radio bursts. This problem will probably be solved in the next decade or so due to much better statistics from experiments like that. That's all I have to say. Thanks very much.
So when you build something like this, do you record how many emissions are produced when you're building it? Or how do you figure out like how much impact it's having on the environment?
Oh yeah, Chime. You know, unfortunately, Chime is like not the most eco-friendly project. It's something like draws 250 kilowatts of power, which is something like 50 households roughly. The Radio telescopes will probably eventually. So right now, I do actually think about that. You know, it's like that's unfortunate. Radio telescopes probably will go solar, especially in a place like South Africa in a desert, which is pretty far away from like power lines and things, and also has a lot of sun. Solar technology is getting rapidly getting cheaper. So there are a bunch of people in radio astronomy that are sort of exploring the use of solar power for an instrument like this. Probably Hyrax will happen a little too soon to go solar, but probably pretty soon. Yeah?
So you showed us like in comparison to FAST, and there was CHIME, and CHIME seemed very much more physically minimalist. And I was wondering, with like advances in computation, how low could we go as far as like surface area and like the actual structure of our telescopes?
What you may be wondering about is you may be wondering why we chose this design with which was a compromise between optical focusing and software focusing, right? We so if we had just had the antennas with no telescope, we would have we would be a lot less sensitive, since the effective collecting area of an antenna by itself. Let me rephrase what I think you're asking, and then you can tell me if it's really what you're asking.
Okay.
Like, what would happen if we had just had the antennas in a field without the backing telescope? Or in the future when computers become like insanely cheap, is that a good way to do it? The challenge is that without the telescope to add collecting area, the effective collecting area of an antenna by itself is lambda squared, the wavelength squared. So we would need a few hundred thousand antennas if we didn't have the telescope to have the same collecting area as CHIME. Now computers keep getting cheaper. Like, the computing cost per antenna is exponentially dropping. So eventually, the computing costs for an instrument like that could actually be less than the cost of building these cylinders. But there are still some other costs that are not dropping exponentially, like the cost of the amplifiers and the antenna itself. So it's sort of hard, except for the exception is at very low frequencies where lambda is large. It's sort of hard to get rid of the optical surface completely. And I sort of doubt that we would have like a telescope-free design anytime soon. It is true that the rate at which like GPUs in particular advance is like really insane. So CHIME has 1,024 GPUs, but if we were building it today with the current NVIDIA GPUs that have tensor cores, we would need more like 100 GPUs. Like, we'd save a factor of 10 in cost between now and like 2017. Yeah?
What's the U of C's role in court?
Sorry?
The U of C, what's their role in CORD?
Oh yeah, there are a couple of people there that, yeah, you notice the Calgary is on. The collaborating institutions are a little different in CORD. I think that's mainly because CHIME has become, you know, kind of this flagship project for Canadian astrophysics, and more people are interested. We're generally pretty inclusive. Like, they wanted to get involved with CORD, and so we're happy to involve them. There are a couple of people there. There's one person that does hardware and one person that does galactic science that are interested. These US institutions are mainly Canadian people who are students or postdocs in Canada that did these US institutions left for the U.S. to get professor jobs.
So you said like there were graduate students who helped design the structure of CHIME. Correct me if I'm wrong. And I was wondering. So these students who also helped design CHIME, did they ever partake in the research that was conducted? So are there any students who helped in both design and conducted research there?
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah. So I would say most people who do hardware also do data analysis, but not necessarily vice versa. Like I only do data analysis, and it would be a terrible decision by Chime to let me work on design an antenna or something. No one would ever do that. The people that people get into physics because they're interested in the big questions. Answering big questions involves like a whole chain of little questions, like how do I build a new amplifier? How do I build a new antenna? So everyone has to like find their niche. But everyone's still really eager. Even if your niche is building antennas, then you're still really excited about the high-level science. And when the data arrives, everyone works on it. Let me also say, so if I could give one like unsolicited piece of life advice, that if you are interested in both physics and computers, I think that's a really powerful combination. Like I tell my students, if you can think like a physicist and write code like a software engineer, then you can work on anything.
You just pointed out that the discrimination between human radio frequencies and those radio bursts we're looking for had to be extremely precise. Did you just discriminate by frequency or what other tools do you find?
Oh, yeah, that's a
human-made background noise.
More than 50% of the code in our real-time pipeline is dealing with this question. Roughly how it works is that you have this data that's coming in like with frequency time axes. And when there's human-made radio transmission, it tends to show up as like some sort of anomalous box in those axes. Like it'll be it'll live in a rectangle. Since a human-made transmitting device tends to transmit in a certain frequency range for a certain amount of time. So we have a bunch of filters that are software filters that are running over the data on a range of different box sizes, looking for statistical anomalies. Like there'll be a filter that takes coarse grains in time by 1,000 samples and coarse grains in frequency by 64 channels, and looks for excess standard deviation. And if it sees it, then it flags that rectangle as being bad. And it builds up sort of a real-time Boolean array of good and bad data. But it's very, it required a lot of trial and error. And the details are probably sort of specific to the Chime site. Since we would put in some list of filters. So we have a list of 100 different rules or 100 different filters that are all chained together in software. We would run for a while, and then we would see that there was some source of RFI in the environment that was, surviving all of the filters and not getting masked. And then, a bunch of people in the collaboration would work and find some software filter that would get rid of that new source. It's like you keep, as you keep doing better, you become sensitive to rarer and weirder stuff. So the list has evolved over time. There's one case that's super hard that still screws us up, which is that the disaster scenario is when an airplane flies over the telescope. So the airplane itself doesn't actually emit that much RFI, but the metal body of the airplane acts as a reflector. So it's reflecting. So we're in a valley. So normally the mountains screen out most of the human-made RFI, within a few kilometer radius. The airplane reflects in all sorts of stuff from very far away, from hundreds of kilometers away. So we just suddenly get this huge variety of signals that we don't normally see. So what we ended up doing is, that was really hard to get rid of with our filtering approach, and we really struggled with it. And then someone had the idea that all airplane flight information, real-time flight information is public, since there are a lot of, there are recreational pilots that want to know. And so we ended up with this really low-tech thing that was really easy to write. It was just queries. Real-time flight status every few minutes, and it knows when an airplane is going off overhead, and then the 1,000 FRBs that we used to, that the software thought that it saw, we know to mask out. I like low-tech things that work. I like simple ideas that work. I'm happy with them.
In the table for fast radio burst potential sources, one of the under the emission line, it said curve. Few of them. So what's that?
Oh, let's look. I have to admit, I'm not actually super familiar with this paper. Oh, okay. Yeah, so okay, this I'm actually not familiar with this table, so I'm not very familiar with this paper, so I'm just like looking at it in real time. So emission mechanism is so synchrotron and bremsstrahlung are two different like emission mechanisms in electricity and magnetism. Synchrotron is what happens when a charged particle, like an electron, goes through a magnetic field, which circulates the particle and accelerates it and produces radio waves. Bremsstrahlung, or free emission, is what you get when like two electrons scatter off each other, or two charged particles scatter off of each other. Now curve, I don't actually know what this is standing for in the paper, but it seems to be applied to more exotic emission mechanisms. But I'd have to look at the paper to see what it actually stands for. But then there's also, in addition to like familiar E&M emission mechanisms like synchrotron and bremsstrahlung, theoretical physicists come up with like wild stuff involving like new particles or this like Schwinger pair emission mechanism where you, if you apply a large enough electric field to the vacuum, you start pulling electron positron pairs out of the vacuum.
I'm interested because you mentioned that you're working on pulsars, like, and the kind of more algorithmic advancement of being able to detect these objects in space. What does the process of like advancing something for your specific research topic, like, how would you go about that, and how come like different ways of approaching algorithm like structure isn't like sound enough right now?
So I tend to be interested in these computational problems. I really like computer science. Like, I read computer science textbooks. I read the computer science archive. And there aren't so many people. So I'm also interested in, like, pure theoretical physics, for example. But I find that I gravitate into the niche of working on computational problems, since there just aren't that many people doing it. There are way more people writing papers on like new particle physics models for the early universe than there are people working on problems like how do you find FRBs super efficiently on the computer or find pulsars super efficiently on the computer.
So what are the problems for finding pulsars super efficiently?
Oh yeah, so the pulsar search problem is actually like much harder than the FRB search problem. But we learned a lot from the FRB search problem. So there are a lot of tools that we can, tricks that we can apply. So for FRBs, you're just looking for a single dispersed pulse, but the data volume is just really large. For pulsars, you're looking for this sequence of pulses where the signal-to-noise per pulse is small. So you wouldn't be able to detect individual pulses in real time. You only see the pulsar after you like appropriately fold the data or combine. Stack the data on itself with some idea for how the pulsar is evolving. And there's like a huge space of possibilities to search over, since the pulsar can, you don't know ahead of time what frequency the pulsar is going to pulse at, or it could be a binary pulsar, or the most interesting pulsars usually are binary pulsars, meaning that the pulsar has a companion, and as it orbits the companion, that the Doppler shift is advancing and delaying pulses. So you have to search over, you don't know in advance when the pulses are going to arrive, and you have to search over this huge space of possibilities. And it involves a lot of really interesting new algorithmic ideas. That's the best I can do without having slides or a blackboard. But if you're curious, I could tell you about the like math details.
Do the more recent repeating fast radio bursts look similar in the different bursts?
Do they have this downward marching structure? So that is a question that everyone wants to know, and unfortunately I have to classify the answer. But our paper's coming out pretty soon. Like, it'll probably be on the archive in like a couple weeks.
Can you say how, like, does the 500 detections rule out some fraction of models? Have you been able to rule out some fraction of this table?
Oh, for sure, yeah. I mean, we have a lot of this, a lot of this field is like statistical. Like there, with 50 FRBs, there might be hints of a correlation between two quantities. If you have 500 FRBs, you can tell for sure. So we will for sure have a lot to say about these the space of possibilities?
Are alien light sails ruled out yet?
Well, you know, I guess, in all seriousness, I think we shouldn't just dismiss. It's hard to like talk about aliens with a straight face, but as scientists, we should be open-minded, and we should have some sort of reasonable answer if someone asks, could they be alien? And so my answer is that if you really take that idea seriously, then why would they be coming from all directions at once? It would have to be some sort of like cosmic conspiracy where there are aliens uniformly spread throughout the universe, and they're all sort of doing the same thing at once. Doesn't really make sense.
Is underwater pumped through the asteroids a continuous hazard for those computers?
Sorry?
Isn't the water that is pumped constantly through those computers a hazard for the data that those computers actually process? I mean, some computer just fail and the water destroy the other neighboring computers as well?
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah. We have we had one leak incident where that happened and some hardware got damaged. And so we do, we put a ton of engineering into making sure that this is all, figuring out what the maximum pressure in every tube can be, making sure that, things are, there's a big enough safety factor that we don't expect anything to fail. We also have like leak sensors, we have some like really heavy-handed, low-level software. There are like leak detectors all over the shipping container where if they like detect, if any water like splashes on a leak detector, it'll like cut off the power. It'll shut everything down, cut off the power to the whole shipping container. And that's a problem in the winter because if you're like walking around in the snow and then you wear your boots in, then you can accidentally set it off. So that's bad, but the positives outweigh the negatives.
What did you find harder, at this project, the computational problems or the theoretical physics part, or the physics in general?
You mean questions like this, which of these? Or do you mean?
No, just the data collection and processing part. Why was it harder? I think the computer science problems, maybe I should restate my question. Is it important at this process to know physics as well, or is it that the people working on the software here just know just computer science? I mean, there has to be equality between the subjects, right?
Oh, yeah. So, we do have a few people with computer science background working on Chime. I would say that for the most part, you do need to know a lot of physics. You need to understand the math of how the observations are made and how you get from the sky to the signals. You need to know what sorts of signals to expect, what's physically plausible and what isn't. And I think it also just helps, in a way that is hard to explain, but I think is important. It's hard to think about the computer science problems if you don't have a really solid foundation in the physics. Like you need to know, just to figure out what problem you're trying to solve, you need to know like which approximations you can make and which you can't, which approximations are good or bad. And I don't think it would be possible to, I think it would be hard to like distill all of that background into some cleanly formulated problem that you could hand off to a computer scientist. There are people with computer science background, and I also think we need to know a lot of math that isn't in a normal computer science curriculum, although there are computer scientists that are mathematically high powered. We do have a few people doing with computer science backgrounds working in Chime, but they tend to do stuff like figuring out the configuration of networking hardware for us, or writing like really, really low level software that sort of shuffles data around between the network cards and the GPU. Things like that that are problems like that you can sort of cleanly formulate for someone with a pure computer science background.
So there are quite a lot of people that think that there's no, I mean, it, that's
there's
no point in studying space, which I think that, well, I definitely disagree. I think a lot of people could disagree with, but I'd like to just hear what you think about that.
I don't know that I've ever heard anyone say there's no point in studying space. I think it's pure research. So the let me interpret your question as like, what is the value of pure research to society? I think these are questions that a technical sounding question like what is the dark energy is really a question in disguise, like how will the universe end? I think everyone really wants to know the answer. Like, what's the modern answer to that question? Like, people have been wondering the answer to that question like before there even was science. I think it's like a privilege to be able to work on a question like that and sharpen the answer that we have as a species. I think there's a lot of value. Most people would say there's a lot of value in answering some, you know, pure big picture questions about the universe.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. That was a really exciting talk.